Thanks, Robert. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you. When Robert gave me my title, I thought I was kind of an interesting choice to give the Breed Association perspective, given that I'm not a staff member of a Breed Association. Heck, I'm not even a member of a Breed Association at this particular time. But I will say that I've benefited greatly from Breed Association data. From beginnings of grad school all the way through the Carcass Merit Project, some of the things we've done at K-State, you know, I wouldn't have tenure if it weren't for Breed Association data sets. And I appreciate the associations being so willing to collaborate and cooperate. And I hope that I've served you with some projects as much as you served me in sort of establishing my academic credentials. And maybe because I have that tenure now that it's okay for me to go up and throw some things out that a Breed Association staff member might not be as quick to talk about, because there are some issues here. If I think back to BIF a few years ago, maybe for some of you that attend BIF on a regular basis, that might have been the first time you heard the letters RF and I put together in that order. That was a kind of one of the next big things. And that's what BIF is all about, is the next big thing. That I can think back to when ultrasound was the next big thing, and that stayability and longevity were the next big thing. And so RFI sort of was going to follow that path. And I think a lot of us at that meeting not too many years ago thought by now that we'd be looking at the SIRE summary and seeing the RFI EPDs. And so maybe part of what I'm going to talk about today is to kind of summarize what you've heard today, because I think both Dr. McNeil and Dr. Herring have done a good job of explaining some of the reasons why, some of the reasons why we're not already publishing those RFI EPDs. That there are definitely some issues in terms of their utilization, that in terms of fully understanding what those can do and not do in our situation. I tried to survey as many of the breed associations that I could at different levels, from CEOs to breed improvement directors to board members to field staff, and in a very informal basis. And some of them may not even been known they were surveying, and they thought I was just BSing with them. But tried to capture as much information as I could about what they were doing and what they felt like their direction is. Nobody told me they didn't foresee some measure of feed intake or feed efficiency in their national genetic evaluation programs. Everybody sees that coming. The difference is just the pace. And the differences really are the questions that have been raised, I think, so very well today. All of them feel like they'll do it, but they all uniformly said they want to do it right the first time. Anytime we bring a new tool to the industry, we want to do it right the first time and make sure that it's in a form that's easy for our commercial bull customers to use. And they felt like, and I think a lot of us feel like, we're getting closer to that than we were. But I don't think today that we have enough questions answered to go ahead and roll that out. We want to do it as quickly as they can. And I would add, and I think BIF's role, and some people have already mentioned this today, BIF's role is also, as best we can, to do that in a uniform manner across the industry. That one of the real challenges, both at the Breed Association part of the industry, as well as my role in the university, is producer education. And if we can make these things as uniform and as understanding across the breeds, then that just makes it more utilizable for everybody. And I think that there will be a BIF role to do that, as BIF has done really well in a lot of traits that we work with along the time. One of the big things I think that we still have to answer, although I think Dr. McNeil did a good job today of talking about, what is the most effective way to deliver the results? And again, the question of whether an RFI EPD is really the most effective way, you know, right now there is a fair bit of data collection. I don't know how much is a fair bit, but more than there was, happening in lots of different places. One of the other things that I do is I'm the faculty coordinator for the Purebred Beef Unit at K-State. We've been breeding purebred cattle at K-State since 1881, make us one of the oldest continuous seed stock operations in the country. So they were doing it for 127 years before I got there, and very well, and I've been doing it for 2 years and we're still in business. So I think so far we're okay. Although some of you will know that some of the things we've been through in the last 2 years, there were days when I wondered. Nonetheless, we actually collected individual intake the first year. If I just keep my hands down, I think I'll be okay. We collected in, you know, as the new faculty coordinator, you know, everybody wants to get out and kill some snakes and do some things exciting and different. And so I got my herdsmen and my barn crew and all those guys. Some of you have come up through that system and had a faculty coordinator come around with lots of great ideas and thought, well, yeah, we ought to do this. And we did it 1 year and we haven't done it since. I think we will do it again. But our experience was that the information that we gained from it in our situation, and that's not to criticize the folks that are doing it, and we were not set up to do it as well as some other people, certainly, in terms of the technology we had, the equipment, the facilities. We relied on a lot of cheap student labor, which is one asset that we do have at the university. But we didn't have a automated system or some of those things to do it. But the other thing that I gleaned from the information was something I really knew down deep, was that there is limited progress that we can make through in-herd selection. We've known that all along with weaning weight, right? When we were working with ratios, we only got so far. We saw that with ultrasound. That when we didn't have ultrasound EPDs, we just had the individual data points and the ratios within our herd, there was only so much they could do with that. And really, in terms of my position of directing the genetics of that cow herd, when I had my within-herd information, there wasn't a whole lot that I really felt like I could do with that, or a whole lot that I could do for my bull customers. Okay? What I needed was what we have with those other traits, a national or international genetic evaluation, where I can benchmark my genetics in my program, in our program, in fellow Kansas taxpayers, your program, against the competition out there and give me a real direction. Because while I had this bull that came to the top and another bull came to the bottom, you know, 100 is average, that didn't really help me a lot in making decisions. So I think we have to go in that direction, but as you know, the points that have been raised today raise some of those questions. You know, most people want that RFI EPD, but the question of how RFI maps to profit, I think is still a consideration. A couple of years ago, Dorian Garrick did a nice job of talking about RFI and how important it is really to incorporate it into an economic index. That you have to take into account not only the amount of feed and the amount of gain, but the relative value of those to the economic system. That the relative importance moves up and down as feed costs change. Now, we're making long-term genetic decisions for sure, and so we make an assumption, hope it's good and go with it. But again, the individual value of RFI by itself may not be the optimum number that we need to change. I think most of us that, from my background, would think that the right way to present this is in an economic index. Whether it's a maternal index or a terminal index, obviously something like this probably is going to get more emphasis in a terminal index, but probably needs to be potentially incorporated. But before we get that economic weight, we have to answer some of William Herring's questions, some of Mike McNeil's questions today, to get that number right. There are certainly some research questions yet to be addressed. You know, the question keeps coming up from cow people, and I wonder about this myself, about this steer efficiency, cow efficiency sort of thing. And as I pulled out of William's comments, he talked about things like appetite and reduced appetite. And folks, the last thing I want a range cow to do is lose appetite. You know, for the people that buy bulls from us, and for the range that we run on in our seed stock operation, that would be certainly a bad thing. Some questions in terms of modeling the expected intake, in terms of how body composition plays into that. That, I think, is still an issue in terms of, you know, if we're calculating an RFI number or something like that, we're measuring the gain over time. Do body composition changes over that time? How important are they? There's conflicting results in the literature, where sometimes fat measurements are significant. In other words, what I'm saying is that if we're measuring an animal and we're trying to say, okay, how much should they have consumed? What should their intake have been? That's commonly done based on the midweight and the rate of gain. Okay? Some have also included changes in body composition. As the animals fatten, those animals that fattened over the period more probably should have had to consume more groceries just to do that. Okay? Do you account for that or do you not account for that? Sometimes it's not statistically been significant, but biologically, if we think about, you know, will we change body composition by selecting for RFI if we don't make that accommodation? We're measuring that generally with ultrasound, which does a reasonable job of measuring body composition, but I'm not sure it's not, you know, no measurement that we make is perfectly precise. And that may be part of the issue in terms of significance. The other thing I think that comes into play from a breed association standpoint, and this is not the major focus of BIF, but I think you have to think about this, you know, think about the way a breed association functions. And that you folks here, you know, I'm not just the only one that tell you this, but in terms of a breed association membership, you're the one percenters. You know, you're up there at the top, you're the people that hopefully are leading the change, driving the direction. But breed associations have lots of other things to do. They have scarce resources and lots of demands on their time and their effort and their money and that sort of thing. You know, I would encourage you folks to be vocal advocates with your individual boards and some of those sort of things to encourage them if you feel like this is a direction that the associations are going to have to take. The other thing that's a little bit different is if we've thought about participation in performance programs, it's been a sort of a one-size-fits-all. That even if you're someone that has three or four calves, like my son, he still turns in weaning weights. He still submits those. They don't make a tremendous impact on the genetic evaluation, but they're used. And it's worth it for us, not just for me from a teaching standpoint, but it's nearly not that much trouble to run those calves through the scales. We've got them up anyway. If we take the next step to a trait like ultrasound, now there's a little more expense coming into that. Okay, is it worth dollars and cents-wise for him to spend the money to scan that small contemporary group? Okay, the amount of information that's gained is not nearly as much as if it were a large group, but the per head expense is still pretty big. Now leap to something like feed intake. There's a significant financial investment and potentially a large reward, but to me, as our genetic change is driven more by large groups, that there's, you know, I'm not sure every person that has registered cattle needs to measure feed intake. And I'm not sure that that's really optimal for the genetic improvement of our breeds and our population and some of that sort of thing. But, you know, Dr. McNeil talked about this idea of commingling groups in feed intake measurement. I think that's an interesting question, and it's certainly a question that needs to be researched a little further. I will tell you from our experience with our 1 year of data at K-State, we had a couple of bulls that were pulled out for some preferential treatment, and those bulls were out of that group and got some really nice treatment for a couple of months, and then they went back, were commingled right back in their original group, and they were together 3 months, just treated all the same. And when we calculated the RFI, those bulls were at an extreme disadvantage. Okay? I'm not sure that you can wash out in 28 days or something like that, some of those sort of things, because of where those bulls were in terms of their body composition, their additional fatness, their additional gain, what they'd been, the way they'd been fed earlier and managed. It made a big difference in their RFI. At first I wasn't even going to calculate it, but I calculated it for interest, just out of my own curiosity. And it was interesting to me to see what that bit of preferential treatment dramatically changed how those bulls intake relative to gain. So I think that could be an issue in terms of putting groups together from different ranches that have been managed a little bit differently and saying we're going to run an RFI or any kind of feed intake comparison on those bulls in a common group. You know, I think that the last challenge I think we'll talk about a little bit is in terms of breed association setting policies and the data quality versus data volume. That breed associations will set guidelines with BIF's help and some of that sort of thing in terms of number of days, the way the feed's recorded, all those sort of things. A lot of the details, sometimes if you haven't done feed intake collection, some of those details sound kind of trivial. But when you start thinking about the rations and the management and the measurement and the days and when this data collection is expensive, the tendency is we want to measure them for as short a period as possible and to get as many turns in our equipment as we can possibly get. Yet we have to say, well, what are those guidelines to make sure that the data quality is adequate? If we lower the quality standards a little bit, we get a lot more data volume. We raise the quality standards, we get a lot less one. And I'm not sure if we know exactly where that sweet spot is for genetic improvement. Certainly, the breed association folks, I appreciate their input. Be glad to take any questions or maybe just discuss with you kind of where this is going. But again, I really appreciate the speakers today bringing this to us because I know I have a clearer picture, but I feel like I have a deeper understanding of some of these issues, have a better direction of maybe where this thing is going to go and where we stand now in terms of feed intake and feed intake measurement.
Thank you, Dan. Any questions for Dr. Moser? Mark said it that way. I didn't see it. I guess I wouldn't make a very good ring man, would I?
You changed sides on me. I was right behind you. Dan, one of the problems I'm having trouble getting through my head, and from an association standpoint, how do we tackle that? But, you know, what we're really talking about is a very expensive trait to quantify that is a lot further away from making an economic impact on the cow-calf producer who has to buy it from the seed stock producer. So what do we have to do to create a pull-through for the trait? Because, you know, thinking of my customers, there might be 3 out of 500 that would even care. And, you know, like if you look at the Beef Magazine cow-calf genetics survey issue, you know, the traits that were most important to bull buyers or commercial customers were probably the least valuable traits as far as economic merit. In that case, you know, live birth weight, which is probably a very lousy selection tool. But the further you got away from their individual circumstances, the less valuable it became. So how do we, if we go through this effort, how do we push it through the chain to where it actually has any benefit?
Sure. I appreciate Sam's question about the continued struggle to assign value to feeder cattle. You know, when it really comes down to me, I think that is a critical issue that permeates a lot of things with genetic improvement and so on, is that creating economic incentives for true value differences that are not easily discovered in a group of feeder cattle. You know, you realize that there's been more proliferation of some of the source verification things. How far is that going to go? And how well does that do? You know, I don't know if more years of data in those programs of participation is going to drive more differentiation of value in those calves. You guys probably out in the field probably have a better feel for that than I do. I will say that, you know, like everything, that there will be some bull buyers to which this will have a dramatic economic incentive. And I can think of my own situation with K-State Purebred Beef, that we have some folks that come to buy bulls that are always, you know, year after year, no matter what, retained ownership type folks or feed their own cattle and those sort of things. And I see they stand potentially to capture tremendous value from it. And there's some of them that have no hope, quite honestly, of doing that. But they're not buying the same bulls anyway, at least in our group. Our strategy is we have some of different sire lines that meet both those customer needs, or at least we attempt to. And I think that'll continue to be the case. But to say that everybody's going to go out and that feed intake or feed efficiency is going to be a primary driver to a lot of commercial cow-calf producers, probably not the way the industry is currently structured. The question was why, if we make a selection on a feedlot steer, why would I not automatically assume that the related cow, the dam, the sister, would also be inherently more efficient? I think it goes back to some of the questions. There may be, you know, I don't know if we fully understand the components of efficiency yet. There is perhaps an inherent sort of almost a cellular efficiency, a digestive efficiency that you might expect to carry across both groups. But that, and again, there could be a grain versus a forage component so that the animal that comes to the top in a concentrate diet may not necessarily come to the top in a forage diet. I think Dr. McNeil asked that and he dodged it really well, and so I'll stick right with that, but I'll at least raise that as one potential issue. If we think about an efficiency of lean gain and some of those sort of things, where a more lean animal fits, where, you know, we tend to think of in terms of pounds of feed, pounds of gain, or even RFI type of steer across breeds, we think of a more continental sort of a deal if we don't put quality into it. If we're just trying to think about lean conversion of gain to pounds of product, that a continental type seems to do that pretty well for the most part. But at the same time, at the cow side, with the additional, you know, mature size that goes with that, it may not be the same thing. And so you have to really think about that the genetic job description for a maternal bull versus a terminal bull can be awfully different. And maybe the genetic package that makes the optimum steer or the optimum sire of a steer maybe not as dramatically as what William works with in the swine business, because they have very dramatic differences in their genetic description of maternal versus terminal lines. But I think even in our business, that there's some very different potential genotypes that optimize in those situations.
Any other questions? Comments?
No. I'd like to offer a scenario, kind of a make-believe thing. Let's say that a bull stud had three bulls they wanted to compare for the cost of production of their calves. So each of three bulls has 100 half-brothers in a pen. Three pens. They're all about equal gate cut from 300 cows. They're all about the same stage of maturity, about the same weight, not much difference in them. And they're fed the same ration. And all it's done is the entire ration is weighed for each pen of bulls. And they come up with a simple pounds of feed per pound of gain for each pen. And bull A has 6 pounds of feed for 1 pound of gain. Bull 2 has 7. Bull 3 has 8. Is that a good prediction of the economic potential of the cheapness of growth of those sires, of their progeny?
I think the question relates to the using pen data as opposed to individual animal data for evaluation of genetics. And there would be potential to use that kind of information, but it has some other properties because you're talking about the average of a group as opposed to an individual measurement. And at the end of the day, you've got three data points. You've got one data point because it's not that each one of those calves in that pen consumed that. It's that the pen is an average. So you have really one data point on each bull. And so while there may be some useful information to that, it wouldn't be nearly as powerful as if you had individual groups of animals. So there might be some value to it, but, you know, for example, you can't assume if you had 6 more pens out of each of those bulls that they would all rank the same. There would be variation across the groups, just like there would be variation among animals. And so by commingling the groups, even when they're penned by sires, that there's a lot of information lost, that you lose a lot of the power that you get from that information.
Don't think one sire would be, the 6-pound sire would not be a talking point or a selling point, a valid selling point, to someone raising feeder calves, but feedlot.
I think there would be a talking point there, but again, it's one data point. I would sort of, this is oversimplification, but in some ways that's like thinking about a bull that has one progeny birth weight. That is a useful bit of information, but that's not nearly as useful as if you had a number of progeny birth weights compared to others in a contemporary group that you could tie together. You see what I'm saying? That there's some information there, but you haven't captured the variation in the animals in the groups. You've just got a simple average of each of those groups. You know, if you could have multiple pens of each sire, for example, that would add to it. If you could pen the calves in smaller groups, there might be a potential to use some of that sort of thing. But again, I think the amount of information you use to make an unbiased evaluation of the sires is going to be a little limited.
Anything else? No, one more.
Dan, your title is relative to breed associations, correct? And you're on the BIF board.
No.
You have been. You're involved.
Yeah.
And you have tenure.
Yes. For now. Subject to the prior. You know. Nothing's forever.
I would assume that the 80-20 rule applies to most breed associations where 80% of the income is provided by about 20% of its members. Would you recommend to BIF a recommended annual membership fee? for members of breed associations.
And then with that, some services that would be provided?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and now I'm really going to sound like a university professor, because the two things that university professors always have, and ARS researchers and everybody else, they ask, more data. How many times have you heard more data at BIF? That should be like a drinking game. Every time that somebody says more data, you know, some of you got that. And the other one is more money, because if we had more money, then that would solve all our problems. You know, there are a variety of creative ways that you can get at that. But right now, there is more money out there for feed efficiency research from the USDA than there's ever been. There's a big, in fact, a lot of people that are at this meeting from my world are in the middle of one or two or three of those proposals. The problem is there's 27 proposals that have made the first cut. They're going to take the top three, and I'd be surprised if more than one of them is going to be for beef cattle. Okay, but there is probably, I hope, going to be, I'll be really upset if there's none of them for beef cattle, but I guess anything could happen. But there will be some significant money into some group of people to work on some of this. Okay, there are other avenues. Some of the associations have done a recently and not so recently done some foundation work toward research. And that, I think, is an excellent idea. More of those are doing that. A lot of times associations have driven foundation work and fundraising work and endowments and that sort of thing towards scholarships and youth activities and some of those sort of things. But research foundations, I think that there is a breeder out there, a number of breeders and these sort of things that would be very excited about a charitable gift if they could see it earmarked toward meaningful research that would move their industry forward. You know, that's another place that everybody's trying to tap in those things, but I think the breed associations could be more active in there. You know, could there be, whether it's BIF sanctioned or otherwise, some sort of a paid group that collaborated to fund research? Absolutely. You know, and you know, one of the things that if you think, you know, traditionally EPDs have been delivered by breed associations in this country, in this species. But that doesn't mean that's the only place that they can be delivered. That if there were a group of breeders that wanted to go after this aggressively and work together and have their, you know, some kind of an association or a group to work in that sort of thing, that I think those things are at least, you know, possible, that they could be discussed. So there's more than one way to go after this. But I think, you know, creative thinking in some of these ways, I think, could come up with some innovative ideas that moves this forward maybe a little faster pace than some might like. Good question. Thank you.